5:06, you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We are here today for Rob and for Veronica. The Midwest is considered flyover country to many people on the coasts. It's a place that allegedly is full of small towns, cows, and hicks.
Well, our next guest refers to the Midwest as a lost region, and he makes the case for bringing more attention to the role we've played in American history. He is John Lauck. He's author of The Lost Region, Toward a Revival of Midwestern History. He grew up in Wisconsin and has lived in the Midwest all of his life. John, welcome to Central Time. Am I right? Did you live in Wisconsin at some point or South Dakota?
I grew up in the town of Madison, South Dakota.
Oh, Madison, South Dakota. There you go.
People from Wisconsin in the 1880s, and it reminded them of Lake Mendota, and so they thought, we're going to name this place.
Oh, really? They named it after Madison, Wisconsin. Wow.
That's true.
That's amazing. So you grew up in South Dakota.
I grew up in South Dakota. I grew up on a farm there, but I've lived in Iowa and Minnesota and spent a lot of time in Madison doing research on various Midwestern history projects. So,
well, it's good that I got confused at the beginning, because one of the first questions I wanted to ask you is what do you mean when you say Midwest? What part of the country are we talking about?
Well, I think the best definition, the most workable definition, was one that was pioneered by a Wisconsinite, Frederick Jackson Turner, way back about 1900, and that is the 12-state region that goes from Ohio over to the Dakotas, Nebraska, and Kansas. And that 12-state region was picked up by the Census Bureau and many subsequent social scientists, and that has been the traditional definition of the Midwest. Now, this definition of the Midwest is not uncontested. It has some ragged edges on it. There are parts of it that people would dispute is actually that Midwestern. The western Dakotas, the southern part of Wisconsin, northeastern Ohio, those don't really fit extremely well. But you have to have some basis of discussion. You have to start somewhere. But there's no question that places like Wisconsin and Iowa are at the center of the Midwest.
So do you think everybody has an understanding of where the Midwest really is, or for some people, is it just any place that's not on the coast?
Well, that's interesting. There's been some psychological surveys of people asking them where they think the Midwest is, and the results are pretty funny in some cases. But if you survey people from the region, they have a pretty good sense of the Midwest being this 12-state region. But the further you get from the region, the more confused people are about what is here. And the truth is they just don't think about it very much. It's not part of their it's just not part of the culture. It's not something they dwell on.
And yeah, it's just sort of like a sea of states that start with the letter I.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of where this project started, because I was doing some historical research a few years ago. And it occurred to me there are these very highly developed and sophisticated fields of study for the American South and for New England and for the Far West, but there is no Midwestern History Association. There's no Midwestern History Journal. There's no logical place to go to have this kind of discussion about the history of the Midwest.
So why do you think that's the case? I mean, do you think it's because you know, there are a lot of similarities between different parts of the Midwest, and I've lived in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Indiana in the Midwest. And some people would say, well, there are differences even within the Midwest.
There are. There's no question. There is a certain variety here, but I think that is, in fact, one of the unifying factors. There is a great diversity in the Midwest, unlike other regions, and I think that's what adds to the confusion. And It makes it difficult for social scientists or anybody who wants to analyze the region to pin it down, and therefore it sort of falls through the cracks. But if one of our goals is to have a healthy and prosperous and pluralistic society, it's a good thing to look at the Midwest and not simply focus on, you know, what's important in Manhattan or what's important in Hollywood or what's important in the old solid South.
Now, you mentioned the South and the East in particular. Could part of that be driven by the fact that and this will probably get to the point of your book too, which is that the Midwest actually had a lot of significance in historical events, but some people could say the Civil War was a large event that sort of defined the South in that way, and maybe that's part of the reason why there's such interest in the South, or the, you know, the Revolutionary War, you know, is a big part of New England, for example, and maybe those are reasons why those regions pop out a little bit more than the Midwest does.
Yes, I think you put your finger on it. The old Confederacy, the states of the old Confederacy, I mean, that is a very unified block of states that people think of as the South. And they understand that as a region. They're very conscious of the fact that that is a region. And therefore, that's sort of conducive to studying the region. And so Southern universities spend a lot of time focusing on the history of the American South. Here, let me give you an example of the differential treatment in regions and the levels of consciousness about region. The University of Minnesota, which is a huge university, as you know, with 50 people in the history department, there is no one, not one single person, who teaches the history of the Midwest or Minnesota.
Now, what's the deal with that?
Well, at the University of Georgia,
yeah.
Just to finish the thought,
yeah.
There are 10 people who teach the history of the American South.
Really?
So that really gives you a sense of the differential treatment of the fields.
And that's incredible.
How many people are dedicated to studying the South and why there's a more robust field of study there.
Now, going back to the point that I was making about the historical significance, you know, the Civil War and things like that, one of the cases I think you make in your book is that we need to realize that the Midwest has played a pretty significant role in the history of the U.S. as well, right?
Well, yes, you mentioned, I go through a number of examples in the book, but since you mentioned the Civil War, I think it's extremely important to point out that if the Civil War had simply been a war between North and South, it's very likely the South would have won and the American Republic would have broken up and our history would be completely different. But luckily for the North, it was able to draw on the resources of the new Midwest, the freshly settled Midwest, which oriented itself toward the North because the North had a decentralized agrarian economy, and it was very different from the South, and Midwesterners wanted the North to prevail. So thousands, tens of thousands of soldiers from the Midwest fought on the side of the North and clearly tipped the balance in favor of the North. And if you look at the old registration rules for regiments from, say, Indiana, Wisconsin is a great example. Minnesota had the first regiment that signed up to fight the war. The places in the Midwest were highly oversubscribed, meaning lots of people signed up far beyond the quotas for these states, whereas some of the New England states had some problems. New York was always under their quota for the number of fighting men. But in places like Indiana, 55% of the men who were eligible to fight in the war marched off to fight on the side of the North and became decisive in the outcome of the war, which changed the course of American history. But
And Wisconsin, too. I mean, there's the farthest North Confederate cemetery is in Wisconsin, in Madison.
Interesting.
You didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
You learn something new about the Midwest every day, I guess.
Well, the other thing that's important to note is, we had the first real Midwestern president at the time of the Civil War, which was Abraham Lincoln.
Right, right.
In Illinois.
So with all this in mind, you've actually examined that despite this, coverage of the Midwest gets, for example, coverage in the New York Times. You did a thing about coverage of the Midwest in the New York Times. What did you see in how the paper covers the Midwest?
Well, I had a meeting with the young man who was assigned to the Kansas City Bureau of the New York Times. Well, and I was very interested in this because most people read the Times, and it's definitely a trend center when it comes to what's important in the culture and what's newsworthy. But when I started talking to him, I discovered that the Kansas City Bureau of the New York Times amounted to one person, and that was the person sitting in front of me. And then I said, well, what is your beat? And he said, well, I am supposed to cover Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, North and South Dakota, Kansas, and Nebraska. And I said, well, that's completely impossible, of course, right? You're not going to even scratch the surface. And he looked at me and said, yes, we simply don't dedicate many resources to this. We dedicate our resources elsewhere. And, this in a nutshell explained how the coast in some ways treats the middle of the country.
We're talking to author and Midwesterner John Lauck about why the Midwest is neglected by the rest of the country.
And we'll be taking your calls next. Do you think the rest of the country overlooks our part of the world? And what do you wish other parts of the country knew about our region? What makes our part of the Midwest so special? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email. That address is talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the discussion. It'll be a lot better when you join it. So call now at 1-800-642-1234. We'll take your calls. But first, here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell, and I'm here today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Veronica Rickert.
We're picking up our discussion now about how the Midwest can be perceived as a lost region. With John Lauck, he is the author of The Lost Region, Towards a Revival of Midwestern History. He grew up on a farm in South Dakota, and he has lived in the Midwest for his entire life.
He's ready to take your calls if you want to, and we want to hear from you. Do you think the rest of the country overlooks our region? Maybe you know a story that shows how the Midwest is best in many ways in terms of a region. What wish other parts of the country knew about the Midwest? What makes your part of the Midwest special? If you're one from one of the coasts and you've come here to live, is the Midwest what you expected to be? We'd like to talk to you about that. Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. And John Lauck, we were talking about how you had a conversation with the bureau reporter for the New York Times and talked about how he had to cover so many different states. Why do you think that's the case?
Well, these are questions of resources and priorities, and they think it's much more important to dedicate many reporters to New York City and the United Nations and to Los Angeles and to Florida and lots of other places in the country, which is a very legitimate decision. Of course, they need to cover these things. But it also, I think, speaks to the fact that they don't think much happens in the Midwest. This reporter, at the end of the day, ended up writing a story when he was on his trip about a giant piece of a big hailstone that was found in the Midwest and set a record or something. And, you know, this was what he considered worth a week's worth of reporting. But I told him afterwards, I said, I think there's a lot of other big stories in the Midwest that you could be writing, and this is sort of trivia. You're not getting at the heart of life in this region, and you need to take the region more seriously and dedicate more resources to it. It hasn't really made a dent, but hopefully with this book and maybe if you continue on in this vein and bring up this topic and keep it alive, maybe we can make a little bit of a difference.
Now, how much of this is the beady and how much of this is the people who live in the Midwest? I mean, I think that there's at least a stereotype that people in the Midwest are understated and they tend to sort of keep, you know, they don't care so much about it. So do you think that if everybody who lived in the Midwest would complain to the New York Times that they're not properly covering their area loudly, that they would aggressively start covering it? Do you think part of it's the fact that we have this sort of low-key nature that we're not standing up for ourselves?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think they might listen. They might be willing to put some more resources into the region. But let's face it, we live in a celebrity culture. And if you do crazy things, if you do outrageous things, that gets you into the headlines. And I think we probably all think to ourselves, this is not a healthy state of affairs. It would be nice if there was more coverage of normal things and you know, healthy regions, which are prosperous and pluralistic and open and functional, and things go well there, as opposed to having the media constantly chasing the latest celebrity scandal. It might be good if they put a little bit more focus on places that weren't so outrageous. Maybe they should focus a little bit more on people who are understated and are doing their job, and maybe we'd have less polarization and less anger in our politics.
Right.
There might be a connection there.
Well, let's go to the phones. Sean from La Crosse joins us. Sean, thanks for calling today.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. I'm 44 years old, and I was born in Platteville, grew up in Spring Green, and all my family came from southwestern Wisconsin. One thing that impressed me about growing up in the Midwest, I live in La Crosse now, as it stated, but growing up in Spring Green, I had the benefit of having, I think, really good agricultural values, being brought up in a really good, solid value system of personal responsibility. But yet, especially in Spring Green, as a smaller town, it had that, and also it had a lot of culture and some progressiveness to it that maybe you don't find in a lot of rural settings, that I think is unique to our area. And, you know, and we're a purple state. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we're not all blue or all red. I think we look at both sides of the spectrum and make our decisions based on, not based on, I guess, the polarization, you know, that was discussed.
Sean, thanks for that call. John Lauck, is that sort of, is he referring to some of the diversity stuff you were talking about, how there are a lot of different kinds of views, maybe?
I think Sean makes a very good point about the agricultural background of many Midwesterners. Remember, and this is why I'm trying to draw people into the history of the Midwest, remember how places like Wisconsin were settled. They were settled primarily by small farmers, people who ended up on 80 acres or 160 acres of land, and people who were merchants in little towns. This was the nature of society here. This is much different than the aristocratic Northeast or the Old South, which was heavily divided by race and it was dominated by a few very large landowners. This has an effect on a society over time, and it makes it different. And since the North, or since the Midwest, was settled by these people who lived in essentially egalitarian conditions, and they approached each other as equals, and they lived in a pluralistic society. There was a wide variety of people from different parts of the world and the country living here. This has an effect on how functional the place is and how nice the place is and how people treat one another. And as Sean says, people here are much more community-oriented and civically engaged, and it's a tradition that goes back a long ways, and I think it's worth remembering that tradition. Unfortunately, we just don't focus on this history very much.
Well, let's go to another call, John from Duluth. John, thanks for calling us today.
Hey, John. What a great discussion, and it really rings a bell with me. See, my family immigrated to Minnesota in 1859, and one of the people ended up serving in the Civil War, and I've never really identified with being from the Midwest. Did you ever find, John, that there's an identifier from being from the North Central, for example, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and Wisconsin as a subset of the Midwest?
That's a great question, John. John Lauck, you want to respond? I know that for example, Northwest Airlines used to be based in the Twin Cities area, and they used to refer to that as the Northwest, right?
Well, there has been different names. There was
right.
The Old Northwest, which were the first five states settled in the north in the Midwest, and this is, you know, Ohio and Indiana and Michigan, et cetera. And then later on, they added on what was called the New Northwest. So this would be Minnesota and the Dakotas, et cetera. And over time, this all sort of was blended into the generic Midwest that we're sort of familiar with today. But within the Midwest itself, there are certainly subdivisions and there are different sorts of areas. Of course, Duluth is much different than, say, Des Moines. But I think that's what makes the Midwest that much more interesting and diverse. And there's a lot of variety here. And people forget that. People from the coast think it's just one big flat area where there's not much variation. But that's not true. And, you know, by the way, is it true, John, that you received 39 inches of snow in Duluth, as I read in the paper this morning?
John has moved on. I think that's probably true, actually. Yeah.
Well, that's an unbelievable number.
So thanks for being with us today, John. John Lauck is the author of The Lost Region, Toward a Revival of Midwestern History. He grew up on a farm in South Dakota and has lived in the Midwest for his entire life.
Coming up next, it's the news, and then we'll be talking about former South African President Nelson Mandela's time on Robben Island. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Mike Arnold. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yesterday afternoon, the world learned that a man regarded as one of the greatest leaders in modern history had passed away. Nelson Mandela was known for his relentless commitment to peace and reconciliation, and he showed grace as he helped transform an apartheid nation of minority white rule into a modern democracy, an accomplishment that few thought would be the peaceful transition it was. Nelson Mandela was 95.
As South Africa and the world reflect on the loss of a man who was seen as a moral compass, questions arise over the future of South African politics and Mandela's effect on other African leaders. Yesterday in Central Time, we discussed Mandela's legacy and got your reactions to the news of his passing. Today, we'd like to take a step back and take a look at one of the defining periods of his life.
In 1964, Nelson Mandela was found guilty of sabotage, a crime punishable by death. And instead of the death penalty, he was sent to Robben Island for life imprisonment. He stayed in prison for 27 years. While many may have lost hope, Mandela stayed devoted to his cause. And after he was released in 1982, he became South Africa's first post-apartheid president. Well, here to discuss Mandela's sentence on Robben Island is Ken Brown. He's a professor of law at University of North Carolina Law School and the author of Saving Nelson Mandela. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about the events leading up to Mandela's trial for sabotage?
Well, he had been arrested in 1962. He had gone underground. He had been up through Africa talking to other African leaders and, frankly, getting some military training. He came back to South Africa and was working undercover with his group, Umgunte Wizizwe, which was the spear of the nation, the armed wing of the ANC and the South African Communist Party. He had gone into hiding, and somehow he was betrayed and arrested on the road just outside of Durban.
And so he was arrested in 1962 for something else.
He was arrested in 62. He was put on trial. He was sentenced to 5 years imprisonment at that point for leaving the country without a passport and for inciting an illegal strike. He was sent to Robben Island. While he was on Robben Island, there was a raid at the headquarters of Umgunte Wizizwe, which was a farmhouse just outside of Johannesburg, in which a number of the leaders were arrested and some 200 documents were found. Some of those documents were authored by Mandela. Some were in his handwriting with plans for sabotage and plan for recruiting militants to be trained abroad. The leadership was charged. Mandela was brought back to Johannesburg, back to eventually to Pretoria to be tried with the others on charges of sabotage, which carried the death penalty.
So, but he didn't get the death penalty. Was there a reason?
He did not get the death penalty.
So,
and,
what's
and
the deal with that?
A remarkable turn of events. When he was charged, when the trial began in October of 1963, I think the conventional wisdom, both in South Africa and abroad, that he would be executed along with the other principal leaders. During the course of the trial, a number of things happened. There were some brilliant legal advocacy by his defense team, led by the outstanding Afrikaner lawyer Bram Fischer, and others. There was some bad advocacy on the part of the prosecution, which irritated the judge. I think that the government may have lost interest in executing him. There were some subtle pressures put on the government at that point. The Americans and the British were not particularly upfront in defending Mandela, but they let it be known that while they probably had no objection to his imprisonment, they didn't want him executed. So there were a number of factors that combined to the sentence of life for he and most of the others. There were two defendants that were acquitted.
And so basically, South Africa was kind of thinking about its position in the world then a little bit.
Well, it's quite possible that there were no statement on the part of the government from which you could find that out, but I've certainly read the correspondence from the American embassy and from the British Foreign Office, and I think that they felt that South Africa was at least somewhat concerned about their place in the world. They at least cared what the British and the Americans thought about them.
So could you tell us about Robben Island, where he was sent?
Well, Robben Island was a general prison when he was first sent there. That is, there were both political prisoners and there were people charged with actual crimes. That was for the first few years. I think the government assumed that the criminals would keep the political prisoners under control. Actually, just the opposite happened. The political prisoners recruited the criminals, and they eventually moved the other people out, and it would simply became a prison for political prisoners. But it was a very harsh place. There was harsh labor in a rock quarry just outside the prison. The prisoners were brought there every day. During the early years, there was not much ability for the prisoners to even to talk to one another except while they were working.
So in an environment like that, how did Nelson Mandela stay connected and engaged?
Well,
in politics?
There was some contact, and the prisoners managed to communicate with each other. There were limited visits from the outside world, but there were some visits. Some of the lawyers were able to come in. Some family members were able to come in. But it was pretty minimal, at least for the first, I'd estimate, 10 years. After that, by the mid-70s, things loosened up a little bit. They were permitted at least to get books. They were not often permitted to get current newspapers, but they could get books, they could study, they could take degrees, and there were lots of interaction at that point. And Robben Island became pretty much like a mini university for very bright political prisoners, and much of the theory of what the new South Africa would be like was formed by the people who were there. It became Robben Island University, as some of the people who were there have referred to it. A friend of mine was on the island for 10 years from the time he was in he was 15. Till 25, and did all of his education there.
So that whole experience on Robben Island has had an impact on South Africa moving forward because of what people learned there.
I think that's right. I think even now politically in in South Africa, there are some distinction made between the group of people who got their education at Robben Island and the group who were in exile. It's just a somewhat different way of looking at it, different factions of the ANC.
So Nelson Mandela was in prison for 27 years. What was it like when he was released from prison in South Africa?
Well, it was a remarkable moment. He actually, the last couple of years of his imprisonment were very different, certainly from the early years. He was in a private house on the outskirts of a prison. He was still confined, but he had frequent visitors. He had visitors from the government. He had visitors from the ANC. He had visitors from his lawyers, and he had begun at that point to exert leadership. So his involvement began in a very serious way a couple of years before. His actual release was a symbolic moment. I think for those of us who were involved at that time, and I was a visitor, but I was there frequently, and that was the moment at which we thought, my God, this is going to happen. This is going to change. And I think there was a general feeling in South Africa, at least among the anti-apartheid people, that finally things were going to get better. We didn't know how long, we didn't know how violent, we didn't know exactly what nature it would take. And a good deal of the reason why it happened and happened in a less violent than everyone thought way was because of Mandela's leadership.
Well, Ken Brown, thanks so much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you for having me.
Ken Brown's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina Law School and the author of Saving Nelson Mandela. Thanks for joining us. This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Gene Purcell. It's Food Friday, and today we're having a spirited discussion about, well, spirits.
Well, as the temperatures have dropped to the single digits, it's mighty cold out there around the state. The days of mojitos and mint juleps, I almost called them mint juleps, on the porch are far behind us. Maybe not for me, it sounds like. But the change in weather does bring its own collection of seasonal drinks.
So, for example, do eggnog and hot buttered rum ring a bell to you? Well, today we're joined by Troy Patterson, and we're going to take a look at some wintry punches and cocktails. Troy is Slate's writer-at-large and gentleman scholar columnist. Troy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first I have to sort of set the stage for you. Right before I spoke with you, I took a look at some of the weather conditions around Wisconsin, and I think we may be one of the hot spots here in Madison. It's 9 above right now. We have a small town in Wisconsin called Winter, where it is 2 degrees below zero as we speak, so it is time for warm drinks. And I'm wondering, besides, you know, just the mere fact that they're warm, what are some of the elements that make up a really great winter drink or winter cocktail?
I think the most important thing is that the mug itself needs to be warm. You've got to pre-warm the mug by pouring some like boiling water into that while you start mixing things up, because otherwise the temperature of the drink itself will drop instantly. It'll have a less pleasant experience.
You know, it's those details that always trip me up. Now I'm understanding my lack of popularity around this time of the year. So warm mug. Key.
That's
okay.
A good first start.
So we got the warm mug. What do we do with it?
That's up to you. I mean, the first thing is to, I'm a big fan of, I mean, I'm always in favor of drinking responsibly. I think that is especially important in the winter. For one thing, it's that, you know, alcohol lowers your core body temperature, and it gets to you more quickly, a hot drink does, than a cold drink, because your system doesn't have to warm it up to body temperature in order to
get
into your bloodstream. Yeah, so that's
a thing
to be aware of. Yeah.
That actually explains.
I used to have people tell me that the warm drinks burned the alcohol off, so you didn't have to worry about it as much. So it's the opposite.
It's the opposite.
Wow. That's good to know.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you guys I'm in New York. You guys are in Wisconsin, which is one of the homes to what I think is the great eggnog tradition of the Tom and Jerry, which is, you know, brandy and dark rum and egg white. It's the most palatable way to enjoy an eggnog, I think.
What are some other regional favorites? You mentioned the Tom and Jerry here in the Midwest, but as we go around the country, are there other favorites, the East Coast, the West Coast, you know, the mountains that we might look at and say there's a drink that defines that area?
Oh, that's a good question, a tough one. I'm tempted to sort of like vamp while I rack my brains to figure something out. I don't know if I have a great direct answer to that question, but I would be interested in like reading a survey of what the ski resort bartenders have to say about.
So you mentioned the Tom and Jerry, which I guess is sort of like an eggnog. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Are there hot drinks that have like milk based products in them, and then hot drinks that have like citrus in them, more like a punch? Are there different themes in hot drinks?
Oh, definitely. I mean, my favorite sort of hot drink that's dairy based is like a hot Brandy Alexander.
Uh-huh.
You know, a Brandy Alexander being brandy and creme de cacao and milk. And I think when that's made warm with some steamed milk, it's like the wonderful, like, exact opposite of coffee. It's sort of like at the end of the night, sort of like a nice, soothing, sort of like steamed milk and brandy and creme de cacao will sort of a great nightcap to send you on your way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't think of any sort of citrus-based hot drinks, but, you know, in making a hot toddy with whatever sort of base liquor you like, I think that a big squeeze of usually lemon and sometimes lime, maybe if it's a rum-based drink, will go a long way towards creating something that is pleasing and provides at least the illusion of giving you good health.
So are warm drinks kind of old-fashioned? Because, I mean, I think of, like, you know, the movie It's a Wonderful Life, you know, the Frank Capra movie where the guy comes into the bar and he orders the hot drink and they throw him out because they think there's something wrong with him. Is that something that – are there some people who, like, if you go into a bar, is it hard to get a hot drink?
I don't know. I mean, I sort of know a few kind of – even dirty little dive bars that always keep like an electric kettle around just in case somebody wants a toddy. But on the other hand, I know some like very sophisticated bartenders who off the top of their head, they have these libraries of 2,000 or 3,000 cold drinks who are sort of like scared of, hostile to, ignorant of, unfamiliar with hot drinks. So it's kind of a specialist area, I suppose.
Let me ask you this. Earlier you talked a little bit about the idea of responsible drinking. Are there some good non-alcoholic versions of these drinks for folks who might want to partake at the party but don't necessarily want to drink alcohol?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, I mean, hot cocoa is hot cocoa. I suppose that you can operate along sort of like general principles. But well, here's one thing that I'll say is that it's fun to just like order a cup of tea in like a good cocktail bar, because you can find out quickly how well you can like accentuate your tea by just playing with some syrups or grating some fresh nutmeg on top, or just using a little bit of some like allspice liqueur to drink up. To spice up something when you're not interested in a serious drinking session.
So as I understand it, you're a fan of punches around the holiday season. What kind of suggestions do you have for us?
Well, there's a classic drink called Philadelphia Fish House Punch that's sort of sweet and fruity. And it hails from, you know, Pennsylvania, the men's club in the mid-1700s.
So what's in a fish house punch?
Yeah, it just doesn't sound very
tasty.
Unattractive,
to me, so.
Yeah.
There's brandy, there's rum, there's a little bit of peach liqueur, there's
wow.
lemon juice, there's sugar. I believe, according to the history of the men's club that originated it, it was invented for a Christmas party. It was the first occasion that women were allowed inside of the clubhouse, and they were looking for a concoction that would be pleasing to the ladies' palates while also making them livelier than is their usual wont.
Huh. Well, interesting. So that sounds interesting. And if you were having a party for the holidays, what would you serve people?
Well, punches are always fun because people gather around them. It's festive. There's an atmosphere of sharing. I like a nice mulled wine is good because you know how parties and houses are. Everyone always ends up in the kitchen anyway, so as long as they're in there, why not put a put a bit of wine in a big stock pot with some spices, maybe a little bit of brandy to give it a kick.
It also is a nice smell in the house, too. It sort of makes the house smell festive, too.
Doesn't it smell like Christmas? It's very sort of...
Oh, my goodness.
And it sounds as though we've lost Troy Patterson. He is Slate's writer at large.
Are you still there? Wait. I can kind of hear you.
I think he's gone.
Looks like we lost your... Well, you know, the fish house punch thing, I believe we actually have that written up somewhere. So we can share that with you. If you're interested in getting it, you can go to our Facebook page, the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll have Troy Patterson's fish house punch recipe on there. Troy Patterson, of course, is Slate's writer at large and gentleman scholar columnist. And we were talking to him on Central Time.
That's right. And again, check it out on our Facebook page. And we've got other recipes that you can share there as well.